swapped it for the impervelope. I relieve you, he said, briskly.
Thank you.
The shorter technician was waiting at the door. The master chief technician paused to say, You needn't have waited. It sometimes takes me 3 times this long to turn over the watch. You are free to leave as soon as the relief junior watch officer arrives. Yes, Master Chief Technician, but this is a very special client, and I thought you might need me with Mr. Snoopy Nose.
I can cope with him.
Yes, a very special client indeed. And it's big swell for you that the skills board assigned you to me when your predecessor opted out. Thank you. Don't thank me, Associate Technician. The voice, although distorted by helmet and relay and filter, sounded gentle, even though the words were not. That was not a compliment, but a statement of fact. If you had not done well on your first watch, there would be no second watch. As you say, a very special client. You did well. Aside from nervousness, a client can feel even though he can't see your face. But you'll get over that. I hope so. I was very nervous. I would rather have an assistant keyed up tight than one who knows it all and is sloppy. But you should be home now and resting. Come along. I'll drop you off. Where do you robe? The intermediate lounge? I go past it. Oh, don't bother about me. But I'll ride with you, if I may, then take the car back. Relax. Once off duty, there are no ranks among us who follow the vocation. Didn't they teach you that? They moved past the queue at the public transports, on past the director's zone, stopped at the smaller bank for executives. Well, yes, but I've never been assigned to anyone of your rank before. Matt got a chuckle. All the more reason to follow that rule with me. Because the higher one is, the more one needs to forget it off duty. There's an empty car. In you go, and sit down. The shorter one went in, but did not sit down until the master chief technician was seated. The boss rejuvenator ignored it, set the controls, sprawled out and sighed as the car started to move. I feel the strain myself, coming off watch. I feel as old as he is. I know. I'm wondering if I can take it. Chief, why won't they let him terminate? He seems so tired. The answer was slow and not responsive. Don't call me Chief. We're off duty. But I don't know your name. Nor do you need to know it. The situation is not quite as it appears to be. He has suicided 4 times already. What? Oh, he doesn't remember it. If you think his memory is bad now, you should have seen him 3 months ago. Actually, it speeds up our work every time he does it. His switch, when he had it, was gimmicked. It simply made him unconscious. Then we would go ahead with whatever stage was next while hypnoing more of his memory tapes into him. But we had to stop that and remove the switch a few days ago. He remembered who he is. But that's not by the canons. Death is every man's privilege. The Master Chief Technician touched the emergency control. The car continued on, found a parking pocket, and stopped. I did not say that it was covered by the canons, but watch officers do not set policy. When I was accepted, I took the oath, and part of it was to give life freely to those who wish it, and never refuse death to those who yearn for it. Don't you think I took the same oath? The director is so angry that she has gone on leave. She may resign. I wouldn't venture to guess. But the chairman pro tem is not of our vocation. He is not bound by our oath. And the motto up over the entrance means nothing to him. His motto is, or seems to be, every rule has exceptions. Look, I knew I would have to have this talk with you, and I'm pleased that you've given me an opportunity before our next watch. Now, I must ask you, do you wish to opt out? It won't affect your record, I'll see to that. Don't worry about a relief. The senior will still be asleep when I next go on watch, and any assistant will do for that watch. which leaves time for the skills board to select your replacement. I want to attend him. It's a great privilege, one I never dreamed would come my way, but I'm torn. I don't think he's being treated fairly, and who is more entitled to fair treatment in this than the senior? I'm torn by it, too. I was shocked silly the first time I realized that I was being ordered to keep alive a man who had terminated voluntarily, or who had been allowed to think that he was terminating, rather. But, my dear colleague, the choice is not up to us. This job will be done no matter what we think. Once I realize that, well, I'm not lacking in professional confidence. Call it conceit. I think I am the best qualified senior watch officer on the list. I decided that if the family's senior was going to have this done to him, I would not opt out and let it be done by colleagues less skilled than I am. Bonuses had nothing to do with it. I've assigned my bonuses to the sanctuary for defectives. I could do that, couldn't I? Yes, but you would be a fool to do so. I draw far more than you do. But I must add this. I hope your body tolerates stimulants easily because I supervise every major procedure and expect my assistant to help, whether it falls during our regular watch or not. I don't need stimulants. I use auto-hypnosis. When needed. Seldom. He'll be asleep our next watch. Colleague, I want your answer now, so I can notify the skills board if necessary. I'll stick. I'll stick as long as you do. Good. I thought you would. The Master Chief Technician again reached for the controls. Intermediate lounge now? Just a moment. I would like to know you better. Colleague, if you stick, you'll know me far too well. I have a sharp tongue. I meant socially, not professionally. Well, you are offended? I've come to admire you without ever having seen you. Now, I would like to see you. I'm not trying to curry favor. I believe you. Grant me the respect of believing that I studied your psych scores before I accepted the board's choice. No, I'm not offended. I'm flattered. Dinner together sometime, perhaps? Certainly. But I had more in mind. What would you say to 7 hours of ecstasy? There was a short pause, which felt long. The Master Chief Technician said, Colleague, what sex are you? Does it matter? I suppose not. I accept. Now? If it suits you. It does. I was simply going to my compartment. Read a while and sleep. Shall we go there? I was thinking of taking you to Elysium. No need to. Ecstasy is in the heart. But thank you. I can afford it. I'm not dependent on my salary. I can easily afford the best Elysium has to offer. Perhaps another time, dear colleague. But a residence compartment here in the clinic is quite comfortable, and at least an hour closer, not counting the time we would waste getting out of isolation armor and dressed to face the public. We'll go straight to my place. I find I'm eager. Goodness. I haven't chanced this sort of lark in far too long. 4 minutes later, the Master Chief Technician let them into the compartment. Large, as promised, and handsome and airy. A happy suite. A simulacrum fire blazed merrily in a corner fireplace and cast dancing lights around the lounging room. You'll find a guest's dressing room through that door, fresher beyond it. The chute for disposables is on the left. Racks for helmets and isolation gear on the right. Need help? No, thank you. I'm quite limber. Well, shout if you need anything. Meet me here in front of the fire in 10 minutes, say. Suits. The associate tech came out in only a little over 10 minutes, free at last of isolation armor and looking even shorter in bare feet and without helmet. The Master Chief Tech looked up from the hearth rug. Oh, there you are. You're male. I'm surprised, but pleased. And you're female, and I am very pleased. But I don't believe for an instant that you're surprised. You've seen my records.
No, dear, she denied. Not your personal dossier, just the brief the board supplies to a prospective supervisor, and they are meticulously careful to keep name and sex and other irrelevances out of it. Their computer program sees to that. I did not know, and my guess was wrong.
I didn't try to guess, but I certainly am pleased. I don't know why I have this special liking for tall women, but I do.
Stand up, let me look at you.
She squirmed lazily.
What an irrational criterion. All women are the same height, lying down. So come lie down here. It's very comfortable.
Woman, when I say stand up, I expect action.
She giggled. You're an atavism, but pretty.
She made a long arm, got him by an ankle, snatched him off balance. He went down.
That's better. Now we're the same height.
Counterpoint, 2. She said, Would you like a middle-of-the-night lunch, sleepyhead? He said,
I did doze off, didn't I? I had a reason.
Yes, I would. What am I being offered?
Name it, just name it. If I don't have it, I'll send for it. I'm feeling very mellow toward you, dear.
All right. How about 10 tall, 16-year-old, red-headed virgins? Girls, I mean.
Yes, darling. Nothing is too good for my Galahad. Although if you insist on certified virgins, it may take longer.
Why this fetish, dear man? Your psych profiles didn't hint at any exotic abnormality. Cancel that order and make it one dish of mango ice cream.
Yes, sir. I'll send for it at once.
Or you can have fresh peach ice cream instantly.
Tease.
I haven't been bothered by that sort of teasing since I was 16 myself. A long time ago. I'll settle for peach. A very long time ago.
Right away, dearest man.
Will you eat it with a spoon, or shall I plaster it on your face? Nor by that sort of teasing.
And just as you have had, and I keep my cosmetic age younger than yours.
A man needs to look mature, and a woman prefers to look young. We always have. But I know not only your rejuvenation age, but your calendar age, Galahad. And my calendar age is less than yours. Want to know how I know, dear? I recognized you the instant I saw you. I helped rejuvenate you, darling, and I'm most pleased that I did.
The devil, you say?
But I am pleased, dear man. Such a nice bonus, and so unexpected. One so seldom sees a client again. Galahad, do you realize that we did not use any of the routine to ensure an ecstatic holiday together? Yet I haven't missed it. I feel younger and happier than I have in years.
Still do.
Me too. Except that I don't see any peach ice cream.
Pig. Beast. Brute. I'm bigger than you are. I'll trip you and fall on you. How many scoops, dear?
Oh, just pile it in until your arm gets tired. I need to restore my strength.
He followed her into the pantry, served them both with heaping dishes of ice cream.
Just a precaution, he said, so I won't get it plastered in my face.
Oh, tut now. You don't really think I would do that to my Galahad?
You're a very erratic female, Ishtar. I have bruises to prove it.
Nonsense. I was gentle.
You don't know your own strength. And you are bigger than I am, as you noted. Instead of Ishtar, I should have named you for that, what was her name? Queen of the Amazons in old home mythology?
Hippolyta, dear. But I can't qualify as an Amazon for reasons you were flattering about, in an infantile way.
Complaints, huh? Over in surgery, they could correct your disqualification in 10 minutes and never leave a scar.
Never mind. Ishtar fits you better.
But there is something unfair about this.
How, dear? Let's take this in and eat in front of the fire.
Suits. Like this, Ishtar. You tell me I was your client,
and that you recall both my ages. So, by masterly logic, I deduce that you know my registered name and family, and you may even... You tell me I was your client, and that you recall both my ages. So, by masterly logic, I deduce that you know my registered name and family, and you may even remember some of my genealogy, since you must have studied it for my rejuvenation. But by the customs of 7 hours, I am precluded from even trying to learn your registered name. I have to tag you in my mind as that tall blonde Master Chief technician who... I still have enough ice cream to plaster you. Permitted me to call her Ishtar for the happiest 7 hours of my life, which are almost over, and I don't know that you will let me take you to Elysium someday. Galahad, you are the most exasperating sweetheart I've ever had. Of course you can take me to Elysium. And you don't have to go home at the end of 7 hours. And my registered name is Ishtar, but if you ever mention my rank other than when necessary, on duty, you'll have real bruises to remember me by. Big ones. Bully, I'm scared. I do think I should leave on time so that you can get your quota of sleep before we're due back on watch. But what's this about your name really being Ishtar? Did I roll 5 aces when we named each other? Yes and no. Is that an answer? I had one of the standard family names of my lineage, and never liked it. But I was delighted and flattered by the pillow name you gave me. So while you were napping, I called Archives and changed my name. I'm Ishtar now. He stared at her. Is that true? Don't look frightened, dear. I won't trap you. I won't even bruise you. I'm not domestic, not at all. You would be shocked if you knew how long it has been since a man was last in this compartment. You are free to leave whenever you wish. You committed yourself to me for only 7 hours, but you need not leave. You and I are skipping tomorrow's watch. We are? Why, Ishtar? I made another call and bucked a supernumerary team into that watch. Should have done so sooner, but you had me bemused, dear. The senior won't need us tomorrow. He's in deep sleep and won't know that he has missed a day. But I want to be there when he wakes. So I rearranged the watch list for the following day, too. And we may stay on watch all day. Depends on the shape he's in. That is, I may. I don't insist that you do a double or triple watch. I can take it if you can. Ishtar, that professional rank you forbade me to mention... You're actually even higher rank than that, aren't you? If I am, I am not affirming it. I forbid you even to speculate about it, if you wish to stay assigned to this client. Whew! You do have a sharp tongue. Did I deserve that? Dear Galahad, I'm sorry. When you are on watch, dear, I want you to think only about our client, not about me. Off watch? I am Ishtar and don't wish to be anything else. This is the most important case we will ever be on. It may go on a long time and be very tiring. So, let's not be edgy with each other. I was trying to say that you, both of us, now have more than 30 hours before we must be back on duty. You are welcome here as many of those hours as you wish. Or leave as soon as you wish, and I will smile and not complain. I don't want to leave, I said so. As long as I don't keep you from your sleep. You won't. And allow an hour to pick up a fresh pack of disposables, robe in, and go through Deacon Tam. I wish I had fetched a pack, but I hadn't planned on this. Oh, we'll make that an hour and a half. My phone had a message waiting in it. The senior does not like the way we look in isolation gear. He wants to be able to see anyone around him, so we must plan time to go through body decontam instead, then attend him in ordinary clothes. Ishtar, is this wise? We might sneeze on him. Do you think I set this policy? Dear, this message was straight from the palace. Besides that, females are specifically ordered to look as pretty and be as attractively dressed as possible, so I must think about... what I can wear that can go through sterilization. Nudity is not acceptable. That was specified, too. But don't worry about sneezing. Have you never taken full-body decontamination? When that crew gets through with you, you can't sneeze, no matter how much you need to. But don't tell the senior that you've had decontam. The assumption is that we simply walk in off the street, no special precautions. How can I tell him when I don't speak his language? Does he have some fetish against nudity? I don't know. I am just conveying the order. One that went out to everyone on the watch list. He looked thoughtful. It's probably not a fetish. All fetishes are contra-survival. That's elementary. You told me that the principal problem was to break him out of his apathy. You were pleased that he was bad-tempered, even though you said it was, hyper-reaction. Certainly I'm pleased. It showed that he was responding. Galahad, never mind that now. I don't have a thing to wear. You'll have to help me. I'm talking about what you should wear. I think it was the Chairman Pro Tem's idea, not the senior's. Dear man, I don't try to read his mind. I just carry out his orders. I don't have any taste in clothes. Never did have. Do you think a lab assistant's coverall would be suitable? It will take sterilization and never show it. And I look quite neat in one. I am trying to read the mind of the Chairman Pro Tem, Ishtar. Guess his intentions, at least. No, I don't think a lab uniform would do. You would not look as if you had simply walked in off the street. If we stipulate that a fetish syndrome is not involved, then the only advantage of clothing over nudity in this situation is to lend variety. Contrast, change. Help shake him loose from that apathy. She stared at him with thoughtful interest. Galahad, up to now, based on my own experience, I've always thought that a man's only interest in a woman's clothes was to get them off her. I may have to put you in for promotion. I'm not ready to be promoted. I've been in the vocation less than 10 years, as I'm sure you know. Let's take a look at your wardrobe. What are you going to wear, dear? It doesn't matter what I wear. The senior is male, and all the stories and myths about him indicate that he has remained canalized by the primitive culture he was born in, not sensually polymorphous. How can you be sure? Myths, dear. Ishtar, all myths tell the truth if you know how to read them. I'm guessing, but it is a reasoned guess, as this is something I used to be somewhat expert in. Until I was rejuvenated, until you rejuvenated me. Then I went into something more active. What, dear? Oh, some other time. I was simply saying that I don't think it matters what I wear. A chiton, shorts and singlet, kilt. Even the underwear I had on under isolation gear. Oh, I'll wear lively colors and something different each watch, but he won't look at me. He'll look at you. So, let's pick out something he would like to see you in. How will you know, Galahad? Very simple. I'll choose something I would like to see a long-legged, beautiful blonde wear. He was surprised to see how little Ishtar had in her wardrobe. In all his varied experience with women, she was the only one he could remember who seemed to lack the vanity needed to buy unnecessary clothes. As he searched, mind preoccupied, he hummed, and then sang a snatch of doggerel. Ishtar said, "You speak his milk language." "Huh? What? Whose? The senior's? I certainly don't. But I must learn it, I suppose." "But you were singing in it. A little song he always sings when he's busy with something." "You mean this? There's a pool-ya by a pawn-shot? I have a phonographic ear, that's all. Don't understand the words. What do they mean?" "I'm not sure they mean anything. Most of them are not in the vocabulary I've learned so far. I suspect that it's just amphigoric rhythm, a self-tranquilizer. Semantically, no. On the other hand, it might be a key to understanding him. Have you tried asking a computer?" "Galahad, I haven't been given access to the computer that records what goes on in his suite. But I doubt if anyone can understand him in depth. He's a primitive, dear, a living fossil." I would certainly like to try to understand him. This language he uses, is it difficult?
Very. Irrational, complicated syntax, and so loaded with idioms and multi-values that I trip even on words I think I know. I wish I had your recording here. The chairman pro tem seemed to have no difficulty. I think he has a special talent for languages. But if you want to try, dear, I have the instructional programs here.
Accepted. What is this, a party dress?
That? That's not clothing. I bought it as a throw cover for a couch, then got it home and saw that it did not fit my lounging room.
It's a dress. Stand there, hold still.
Oh, don't tickle. Variations on a theme. 1. Affairs of State. Despite what I told the senior, my ancestor grandfather, Lazarus, I work hard in governing Secundus, but only in thinking about policy and in judging the work of others. I don't do donkey work. I leave that to professional administrators. Even so, the problems of a planet with more than 1 billion people can keep a man busy, especially if his intention is to govern as little as possible, as that means he must keep a sharp eye out and his ear tuned for signs that subordinates are doing unnecessary governing. Half my time is used in the negative work of plucking such officious officials and ordering that they never again serve in any public capacity. Then I usually abolish their jobs, and all jobs subordinate to them. I have never noticed any harm with such pruning, save that parasites whose jobs are eliminated must find some other way to avoid starvation. They are welcome to starve, better if they do, but they don't. The important thing is to spot these malignant growths and remove them while they are small. The more skill a chairman pro tem acquires in this, the more emerging ones he finds, which keeps him busier than ever. Anyone can see a forest fire. Skill lies in sniffing the first smoke. This leaves me too little time for my prime work, thinking about policy. The purpose of my government is never to do good, but simply to refrain from doing evil. This sounds simple, but is not. For example, although prevention of armed revolution is obviously part of my main duty, i.e. to keep order, I began to have doubts about the wisdom of transporting potential revolutionary leaders years before Grandfather Lazarus called my attention to it. But the symptom that roused my worry was so null that it took 10 years for me to notice it. During those 10 years, there was not one attempt to assassinate me. By the time Lazarus Long returned to Secundus, for the purpose of dying, this disturbing symptom had continued 20 years. This was ominous, and I realized it. A population of 1 billion plus so contented, so uniform, so smug, that not one determined assassin shows up in a double decade is seriously ill, no matter how healthy it looks. In the 10 years that elapsed after I noticed this lack, I worried about it every hour I could spare, and found myself asking myself over and over again, what would Lazarus Long do? I knew in broad outline what he had done, and that was why I decided to migrate, either lead my people off-planet or go alone if none would follow. In rereading this, it sounds as if I sought to be assassinated in some mystic "the king must die" sense. Not at all. I am surrounded at all times by powerful and subtle safeguards, the nature of which I will not divulge. But there is no harm in mentioning 3 negative precautions. My facial appearance is not known to the public. I almost never appear in public anyhow, and when I do, it is never announced. The job of ruler is dangerous, or should be, but I don't intend to die from it. The disturbing symptom was not that I am alive, but that there are no dead assassins. No one seems to hate me enough to try. Frightening. Where have I failed them? When the Howard Clinic notified me that the senior was awake, with a reminder that only one night had passed for him, I was not only awake, but had completed necessary work and bucked the rest. I went at once to the clinic. After they decontaminated me, I found him dawdling over coffee,
having just finished breakfast. He glanced up and grinned.
Hi, Ira.
Good morning, Grandfather. I went to him ready to offer a respectful salutation, such as he had permitted when I bade him good night, the night before, but watching for signs that say yes or no before the mouth speaks. Even among the families there is wider, but watching for signs that say yes or no before the mouth speaks. Even among the families there is wide variety in such customs, and Lazarus is, as always, a law unto himself. So I closed the last of the gap with great deliberation. He answered me by drawing back so slightly that it would have been unnoticeable had I not been alert for it. He added a gentle warning, "Stranger's present, son." I stopped at once.
"At least I think they are strangers," he added. "I've been trying to get acquainted, but all we share is some pigeon speech plus a lot of hand-waving. But it's nice to have people around instead of those zombies. We get along. Hey, dear, come here. Yeah, that's a good girl."
He motioned to one of his rejuvenation technicians. Two on watch, as usual, and this morning one was female, one was male. I was pleased to see that my order that females should dress attractively had been carried out. This woman was a blonde, graceful, and not unattractive if one likes tallness in a female. I don't dislike it, but there is something to be said for one small enough to fit on one's lap. Not that I've had much time for that lately. She glided forward and waited, smiling. She was dressed in something, women's styles don't stay the same long enough for me to keep track, and this was a period when every woman in New Rome seemed to be trying to dress differently from every other woman. Whatever it was an iridescent blue that set off her eyes and fitted her closely where it covered her at all. The effect was pleasing.
"Ira, this is Ishtar. Did I get your name right that time, dear?"
"Yes, senior."
"And that young man over there, believe it or not, Galahad. Know any legends of Earth, Ira? If he knew its idiomatic meaning, he would change it. The perfect knight who never got any. But I've been trying to remember why Ishtar's face is so familiar. Dear, was I ever married to you? Ask her for me, Ira. She may not have understood."
"No, senior. Not never. Is certain."
"She understood you," I said. "Well, that could have been her grandmother. A lively wench, Ira. Tried to kill me, so I left her."
The chief master technician spoke briefly in Galacta. I said, "Lazarus, she says that while she has never had the honor of being married to you, contractually or informally, she is quite willing if you are."
"Well, a saucy one. It must have been her grandmother. 800, 900 years back, more or less. At least track of half centuries. And on this planet. Ask her if, Ariel Barstow is her grandmother."
The technician looked very pleased and broke into rapid galacta. I listened and said, "She says that Ariel Barstow is her great-great-great-grandmother, and she is joyed to hear you acknowledge the connection, as that is the lineage by which she is descended from you, and that she would be supremely honored, both for herself and on behalf of her siblings and cousins, if you would converge the lineage again, with or without contract. After your rejuvenation is completed," she adds, "she is not trying to rush you. How about it, Lazarus? If she has used up her reproduction quota, I would be happy to grant her an exception so that she would not have to migrate."
"The hell, she ain't trying to rush me. And so are you."
But she put it politely, so let's give it a polite answer. Tell her that I'm honored and her name goes into the hat. But don't tell her I'm shipping out on Thursday. Don't call us, we'll call you, in other words. But make her happy about it. She's a nice kid. I revised the message diplomatically. Ishtar beamed, curtsied, and backed away. Lazarus said,
"Drag up a rock, son, and sit a while."
He lowered his voice and added,
"Between ourselves, Ira, I'm pretty sure Ariel slipped one in on me, but with another of my descendants. So this kid is descended from me anyhow, though maybe not as directly. Not that it matters. What are you doing up so early? I said you could have 2 hours after breakfast to yourself. I'm an early riser, Lazarus. Is it true that you have decided on the full course? She seems to think so. Lazarus looked pained. It's probably the simplest answer, but how do I know I'll get my own balls back?
Gonads from your clone are your own, Lazarus. That's basic to the theory.
Well, we'll see. Early rising is a vice, Ira. It'll stunt your growth and shorten your days. Speaking of such, Lazarus glanced up at the wall. Thanks for having that switch reinstalled. I don't feel tempted by it this fine morning, but a man does like to have a choice. Galahad, coffee for the chairman and fetch me that plastic envelope.
Grandfather Lazarus supplemented his order with gestures, but I think the tech understood his words. Or was somewhat telepathic. Rejuvenators are quite empathetic. Need to be. The man moved at once to comply. He handed Lazarus an impervelope and poured coffee for me, which I did not want, but we'll drink anything protocol requires. Lazarus went on.
Here's my new will, Ira. Read it and file it somewhere and tell your computer. I've already approved the way she worded it and read it back into her and told her to place it in her permanence with a bind on it. It'd take a Philadelphia lawyer to diddle you out of your inheritance now, though no doubt one could.
He waved the mail tech aside.
No more coffee, lad. Thanks. Go sit down. You go sit too, dear. Ishtar?
Ira, what are these young people?
Nurses? Orderlies? Servants? Or what? They hover over me like a hen with one chick. I've never cared for more service than I need. Just sociability. Human company.
I could not answer without inquiring. Not only is it unnecessary for me to know how the rejuvenation clinic is organized, but also it is private enterprise, not under the trustees, and my intervention in the case of the senior was much resented by its director. So I interfered as little as possible, as long as my orders were carried out. I spoke to the female tech in Galacta. What is your professional designation, ma'am? The senior wants to know. He says that you have been behaving like a servant. She answered quietly.
It is our pleasure to serve him in any way we can, sir.
Then hesitated and went on.
I'm Administrator Master Chief Rejuvenation Technician Ishtar Hardy, Deputy Director for Rejuvenation Procedures, and my assistant, Watch Officer, is Associate Technician Galahad Jones.
Having been rejuvenated twice, and used to the idea all my life, it does not surprise me when cosmetic age does not match calendar age. But I admit to surprise at learning that this young woman was not just a technician, but boss of her department, probably number 3 in the entire clinic, or possibly number 2 while the director was away sulking in her tent, damn her duty-struck stiff neck, or even director pro tem with her deputy, or some department head, bucked into minding the store. So, I answered, may I ask your calendar age, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chairman Pro Tem may ask anything. I am only 147 years old, but I am qualified. This has been my only career since first maturity.
I did not imply doubt of your qualifications, madam, but I am astonished to see you standing a watch rather than sitting at a desk, although I confess I don't know how the clinic is organized. She smiled slightly.
Sir, I could express a similar feeling at your own personal interest in this case, were it not that I think I understand it.
I am here because I chose not to delegate the responsibility. He is the senior. I have screened all the watch officers assigned to him. The best we have to offer.
I should have known it.
We understand each other. I added, I am pleased. But may I make a suggestion? Our senior is independent by temperament and highly individualistic. He wants a minimum of personal service, only that which he must have.
Have we been annoying him, sir? Too solicitous? I can watch and listen from outside the door and still be here instantly if he wants something.
Possibly too solicitous. But stay inside. He does want human companionship.
What's all this yak-yak? Demanded Lazarus.
I had to ask questions, Grandfather. As I don't know the organization of the clinic, Ishtar is not a servant. She is a rejuvenator, and a highly skilled one. And so is her assistant. But they are happy to supply any service you want.
I don't need flunkies. I'm feeling pretty good today. If I want anything, I'll shout. They don't need to hang over me hand and foot.
Then he grinned.
But she's a cute little trick. In the large economy size. It's a pleasure to have her around. Moves like a cat. No bones, just flows. She does indeed remind me of Ariel. Did I tell you why Ariel tried to kill me?
No, I would like to hear if you want to tell me.
Ask me when Ishtar isn't around. I think she knows more English than she lets on. But I did promise to talk if you showed up to listen. What would you like to hear?
Anything, Lazarus. Scheherazade picked her own subjects.
So she did. But I don't have one on tap.
Well, you said as I came in that early rising is a vice. Did you mean that seriously?
Maybe. Ramp Johnson claimed it was. He used to tell a story about a man who was condemned to be shot at sunrise, but overslept and missed it. His sentence was commuted that day, and he lived another 40-50 years. Said it proved his point.
Do you think that's a true story?
As true as any of Scheherazade's. I took it to mean, sleep whenever you can. You may have to stay awake a long time. Early rising may not be a vice, Ira, but it is certainly no virtue. The old saw about the early bird just goes to show that the worm should have stayed in bed. I can't stand people who are smug about how early they get up.
I didn't mean to sound smug, Grandfather. I get up early from long habit, the habit of work, but I don't say it's a virtue.
Which, work or early rising? Neither is a virtue. But getting up early does not get more work done. Any more than you can make a piece of string longer by cutting off one end and tying it onto the other. You get less work done if you persist in getting up yawning and still tired. You aren't sharp and make mistakes and have to do it over. That sort of busy is wasteful, as well as unpleasant and annoying to those who would sleep late if their neighbors weren't so noisily active at some ungodly cow-milking hour. Ira, progress doesn't come from early risers. Progress is made by lazy men looking for easier ways to do things.
You make me feel that I've wasted 4 centuries.
Perhaps you have, son, if you spend it getting up early and working hard. But it's not too late to change your ways.
Don't fret about it. I've wasted most of my long life. Though perhaps more pleasantly.
Would you like to hear a story about a man who made laziness a fine art?
His life exemplified the principle of least effort.
A true story.
Certainly, but I don't insist on its being true.
Oh. I won't let truth hamper me, Ira. I'm a solipsist at heart. Hear then, O mighty king.
Variations on a theme, 2. The tale of the man who was too lazy to fail.
He was a schoolmate of mine in a school for training naval officers. Not space navy. This was before the human race had even reached Earth's one satellite. This was wet navy. Ships that floated in water and attempted to sink each other, often with regrettable success. I got mixed up in this through being too young to realize emotionally that if my ship sank, I probably would sink too. But this is not my story, but David Lamb's.
Footnote. There is no record that the senior ever attended a school for military naval officers, or any military school. On the other hand, there is no proof that he did not. This story may be autobiographical, to whatever extent it is true. David Lamb may be one more of the many names used by Woodrow Wilson, Smith. The details are consistent with old Holmes' history so far as we know it. The senior's first century coincides with that century of continuous war which preceded the Great Collapse.
a century of much scientific progress, paralleled by retrogression in social matters. Waterborne and airborne ships were used for fighting throughout this century. See appendix for idioms and technicalities. Justin Foote, the 45th.
To explain David, I must go back to his childhood. He was a hillbilly, which means he came from an area uncivilized, even by the loose standards of those days. And Dave came from civilhood. He was a hillbilly, which means he came from an area uncivilized, even by the loose standards of those days. And Dave came from so far back in the hills that the hoot owls trod the chickens. His education was in a one-room country school and ended at 13. He enjoyed it, for every hour in school was an hour sitting down doing nothing harder than reading. Before and after school, he had to do chores on his family's farm, which he hated, as they were what was known as honest work, meaning hard, dirty, inefficient, and ill-paid, and also involved getting up early, which he hated even worse. Graduation was a grim day for him. It meant that he now did honest work all day long instead of spending a restful 6 or 7 hours in school. One hot day, he spent 15 hours plowing behind a mule, and the longer he stared at the south end of that mule, breathing dust it kicked up and wiping the sweat of honest toil out of his eyes, the more he hated it. That night he left home informally, walked 15 miles to town, slept across the door of the post office until the postmistress opened up next morning, and enlisted in the Navy. He aged 2 years during the night, from 15 to 17, which made him old enough to enlist. A boy often ages rapidly when he leaves home. The fact was not noticeable. Birth registrations were unheard of at that time and place, and David was 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, well-muscled, handsome, and mature in appearance, save for a wild look around the eyes. The Navy suited David. They gave him shoes and new clothes and let him ride around on the water, seeing strange and interesting places, untroubled by mules and the dust of cornfields. They did expect him to work, though not as much or as hard as working a hill farm. And once he figured out the political setup aboard ship, he became adept at not doing much work while still being satisfactory to the local gods, namely chief petty officers. But it was not totally satisfactory, as he still had to get up early and often had to stand night watches and sometimes scrub decks and perform other tasks unsuited to his sensitive temperament. Then he heard about this school for officer candidates, midshipmen, as they were known. Not that David cared what they were called. The point was that the Navy would pay him to sit down and read books, his notion of heaven, untroubled by decks to scrub and by petty officers. Oh, King, am I boring you? No? Very well. David was ill-prepared for this school, never having had 4 to 5 years additional schooling considered necessary to enter it. Mathematics, what passed for science, history, languages, literature, and so forth. Pretending to 4 years or so of schooling he did not have was more difficult than tacking 2 years on the age of an overgrown boy. But the Navy wished to encourage enlisted men to become officers, so it had established a tutoring school to aid candidates slightly deficient in academic preparation. David construed slightly deficient to mean his own state. He told his chief petty officer that he had just missed graduating from high school, which was true, in a way. He had just missed by half a county, that being the distance from his home to the nearest high school. I don't know how David induced his CPO to recommend him. David never discussed this. Suffice to say that when David's ship steamed for the Mediterranean, David was dropped at Hampton Roads 6 weeks before the tutoring school convened. He was a supernumerary during that time. The personnel officer, in fact his clerk, assigned David to a bunk in a mess and told him to stay out of sight during working hours in the empty classrooms where his fellow hopefuls would meet 6 weeks later. David did so. The classrooms had in them books used in tutoring and academic subjects a candidate might lack. and David lacked them all. He stayed out of sight and sat down and read. That's all it took. When the class convened, David helped tutor in Euclidean geometry, a required subject and perhaps the most difficult. 3 months later, he was sworn in as a naval cadet on the beautiful banks of the Hudson River at West Point. David did not realize that he had jumped from the frying pan into the fire. The sadism of petty officers is a mild hit-or-miss thing compared with the calculated horrors visited on new cadets, plebes, by cadets of the senior classes, especially by the senior-most, the first classmen, who were walking delegates of Lucifer in that organized hell. But David had 3 months to find this out and to figure out what to do, that being the time upper classes were on the briny, practicing warfare. As he saw it, if he could last 9 months of these hazards, all the kingdoms of Earth would be his. So he said to himself, if a cow or a countess can sweat out 9 months, so can I. He arranged the hazards in his mind in terms of what must be endured, what could be avoided, and what he should actively seek. By the time the lords of creation returned to stomp on the plebes, he had a policy for each typical situation and was prepared to cope with it under doctrine, varying doctrines only enough to meet variations in situations, rather than coping hastily on an improvised basis. This is more important to surviving in tough situations than it sounds. For example, David's grandpa, that is, warned him never to sit with his back to the door. Son, he said to him, might be 999 times you get away with it. No enemy of yourn would come through that door. But the 1,000th time, that's the one. If my own grandpa had always obeyed that rule, he might be alive today and still jumping out bedroom windows. He knew better, but he missed just once through being too anxious to sit in on a poker game, and thereby took the one chair open, one with its back to the door. And it got him. He was up out of his chair and emptied 3 shots from each of his guns into his assailant before he dropped. We don't die easy. But 'twas only a moral victory. He was essentially dead with the bullet in his heart before he got out of that chair, all from sitting with his back to an open door. Ira, I've never forgotten Gramps' words, and don't you forget 'em. So David categorized the hazards and prepared his doctrines. One thing that had to be endured was endless questioning, and he learned that a plebe was never permitted to answer, "I don't know, sir," to any upperclassman, especially a firstclassman. But the questions ordinarily fell into categories: history of the school, history of the Navy, famous naval sayings, names of team captains and star players of various athletic sports, how many seconds till graduation, what's the menu for dinner. These did not bother him. They could be memorized, save the number of seconds remaining till graduation, and he worked out shortcuts for that, ones that stood him in good stead in later years. What sort of shortcuts, Lazarus? Eh? No, nothing fancy. A pre-calculated figure for reveille each morning, a supplementary figure for each hour thereafter, such as 5 hours after 6 o'clock reveille subtracts 18,000 seconds from the base figure, and 12 minutes later than that takes off another 720 seconds. For example, at noon formation, 100 days before graduation, say at exactly 12:01 and 13 seconds, figuring graduation at 10 a.m., which was standard, David could answer 8,632,727 seconds, sir, almost as fast as his squad leader could ask him, simply from having pre-calculated most of it. At any other time of day, he would look at his watch and pretend to wait for the second hand to reach a mark, while in fact performing subtractions in his head. But he improved on this. He invented a decimal clock, not the one he used here in Secundus, but a variation on Earth's clumsy 24-hour day, 60-minute hour, 60-second-minute system then in vogue. He split the time for reveille to taps into intervals and sub-intervals of 10,000 seconds. 1,000 seconds, 100 seconds, and memorized a conversion table. You see the advantage? For anyone but Andy Libby, God rest his innocent soul, subtracting 10,000 or 1,000 from a long string of digits up in the millions is easier to do in your head, quickly and without error, than it is to subtract 7,273. The figure to be subtracted in the example I just gave. David's new method did not involve carrying auxiliary figures in the mind while searching for the ultimate answer. For example, 10,000 seconds after reveille is 8:46:40 a.m. Once David worked out his conversion table and memorized it, it took him less than a day. Just memorizing was easy for him. Once he had that down pat, he could convert to the 100-second interval coming up next almost instantly. Then add, not subtract, two digits representing the time still to go to the last two places in his rough answer to get his exact answer. Since the last two places were always zeros, check it yourself, he could give an answer in millions of seconds as fast as he could speak the figures and have it right every time. Since he didn't explain his method, he got a reputation for being a lightning calculator, an idiot savant talent, like Libby. He was not. He was simply a country boy who used his head on a simple problem. But his squad leader got so groused at him for being a smartass, meaning that the squad leader couldn't do it, that he ordered Dave to memorize the logarithm tables. That didn't faze Dave. He didn't mind anything but honest work. He set out to do so. 20 new ones each day, that being the number this first classman thought would suffice to show up this smartass. The first classman grew tired of the matter when Dave had completed only the first 600 figures, but Dave kept at it another 3 weeks through the first 1,000, which gave him the first 10,000 figures by interpolation and made him independent of log tables, a skill that was of enormous use to him from then on, computers being effectively unknown in those days. But the unceasing barrage of questions did not bother David, save for the possibility of starving to death at mealtimes. And he learned to shovel it in fast while sitting rigidly at attention and still answer all questions flung at him. Some were trick questions, such as, "Mister, are you a virgin?" Either way a plebe answered, he was in trouble. If he gave a straight answer. In those days, some importance was placed on virginity, or the lack of it. I can't say why. But trick questions call for trick answers. Dave found that an acceptable answer to that one was, "Yes, sir, in my left ear." Or possibly his belly button. But most trick questions were intended to trap a plebe into giving a meek answer. And meekness was a mortal sin. Say a first classman said, "Mister, would you say I was handsome?" An acceptable answer would be, "Perhaps your mother would say so, sir, but not me." Or, "Sir, you are the handsomest man I ever saw who was intended to be an ape." Such answers were chancy. They might flick at first classmen on the raw. But they were safer than meek answers. But no matter how carefully a plebe tried to meet impossible standards, about once a week some first classman would decide that he needed punishment. Arbitrary punishment without trial. This could run from mild, such as exercises repeated to physical collapse, which David disliked as they reminded him of honest work, up to paddling on the buttocks. This may strike you as nothing much, Ira, but I'm not speaking of the paddling children sometimes receive. These beatings were delivered with the flat of a sword, or with a worn-out broom that amounted to a long, heavy club. Three blows delivered by a grown man in perfect health would leave the victim's bottom a mass of purple bruises and blood blisters, accompanied by excruciating pain. David tried hard to avoid incidents likely to result in this calculated torture, but there was no way to avoid them entirely, short of quitting, as some first classmen awarded such blows through sheer sadism. David gritted his teeth and accepted them when he had to, judging correctly that he would be run out of school if he defied the supreme authority of a first classman. So he thought about the south end of that mule and endured it. There was a much greater hazard to his personal safety and future prospects of a life free from honest work. The mystique of military service included the idea that a prospective officer must excel in athletic sports. Do not ask why. It was no more subject to rational explanation than is any other branch of theology. Plebes in particular had to, no choice, go out for sports. 2 hours each day, which were nominally free, David could not spend napping or dreaming in the quiet of the school's library, but must, perforce, spend in sweaty exercise. Where still, some sports were not only accepted.